This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning and welcome to NSPS Radio Hour for another edition. We're happy this week to have Tom Little with us from SmartVent. I think some of our listeners will recognize the name SmartVent and will know even more about it after we're finished with the show today. So welcome to the show, Tom.
Hey, thanks so much, Kurt, for having me.
I became interested in having Tom on the show over a period of time because I've seen a lot of representatives at our state surveying conferences demonstrating SmartVent products and services. And I've had an opportunity to talk to quite a few of those folks from around the country, and Tom will tell us more about that team as we get into this. But I think I mentioned to you, Tom, that Lisa Isom, who manages our liability insurance program for NSPS, a couple of times I've been at conferences, and she's kind of drafted your person to work with her to give a little presentation to a you know, a specific group, and that always seemed to work out well, and people were interested in it. So I thought it would be a good idea to bring you on to talk about SmartVent, and maybe we can start out by by you giving folks a little bit of a background on you.
Yeah, absolutely. So Tom Little with SmartVent Products. We've been in business for 15 years, and a lot of folks know us as manufacturers of a line of ICC-certified flood venting systems. But we've developed into a lot more over those years. We have a team of certified floodplain managers, and I'm a CFM myself, and I'm also a licensed insurance agent. And it's a pretty unique background that I bring to the table because I understand the codes and the FEMA regulations, but then I also understand how enforcement of those codes and regs translate into lower flood insurance premiums. So over our 15-year existence, we've really developed into a consulting outfit and we offer this experience and service and know-how totally complimentary through our program called the Flood Risk Evaluator. And that gives us the ability to guide homeowners, surveyors, other insurance professionals, community officials, and so forth through, you know, the development process with building in the floodplain. And then what we're able to do is also show them how compliance translates into a flood insurance premium. And so, really exhibiting at the various state conferences through those 15 years. As you said, we have a team of field representatives that are also CFMs that you'll find at these various state associations. And we do one of our CE-approved educational courses there, not just on flood vents, but really on the overall way you're supposed to design within the floodplain. The ultimate goal is to make a more flood-resistant community.
And that team, I'm going to assume, based on where I've seen some of those folks, is a nationwide team. Because, for example, I know last spring, I guess it was, I was at the conference out in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've seen folks in other parts of the country. So now, are all those people consultants with you or tied to the company somehow, or are they direct employees, or how does that work?
Yeah, there's a mix. You know, we probably have about 17 folks out in the field working the various states, the Northwest, up and down the West Coast into the Gulf and the entire Atlantic side. And then as you get into the Great Lakes region, we have representatives out there. And some of these folks are full-time SmartVent flood risk evaluator employees. There's certified floodplain managers that I mentioned, and then there's a handful that are independent representatives that maybe represent other lines. But for the most part, their time is dedicated to floodplain management practice and the ability to guide and assist and consult various professionals when building in the floodplain. And then, so that's our technical representative team, Kurt. And then we also have dealers all across the country, and we distribute our product line through independent lumber and building material suppliers and masonry yards, and then also have authorized installers that can come in, which we're going to get into talking about retrofits to lower residents' flood insurance premiums.
So that's a pretty broad and diverse team of folks you have involved. And of course, I know from the surveyor standpoint, unless they happen to have property where flood vents are of need, and maybe you're going to tell us as we go through today that that could be anywhere. That may be true, but certainly from the perspective of more educational perspective for surveyors, because one of the things that in dealing with FEMA over the years, and we even started a program a few years ago, which is still going on in North Carolina, called the Certified Floodplain Surveyor Program, and we've attempted to bring that to other areas over time, and hasn't happened yet. But what we find is that among the ones of us, obviously I count myself in that category in the surveying profession, grasping all of the things you need to know to deal with the certificates beyond just providing the field data becomes a challenge for the surveying profession. And so now I think that's one of the reasons people are interested in what you guys are doing.
Yeah, and that's something that we've seen, and as I said, we've over the 15 years have really developed an understanding on how the elevation certificates used from a floodplain management standpoint. What is the floodplain manager looking for in a community? Well, they're looking to ensure that they are enforcing their floodplain management ordinance. And then so there's been a lot of focus on, okay, what is that building official, that construction official, going to be looking for in his community? And then the disconnect's always been the insurance side of things, which is when it comes to flood insurance, we have the National Flood Insurance Program in the United States that provides federally backed flood insurance for participating communities. And there's over 20,000 communities participating in the NFIP program. All of your prominent communities that have many special flood hazard areas. And so with these courses now and our understanding, we're able to get in front of a group of surveyors that are completing elevation certificates and explain to them what those numbers mean to a licensed insurance agent. Somebody like myself, what am I looking for from that form to be able to rate a resident, a homeowner's flood insurance policy? So the courses are really designed to go into detail on how does an insurance agent think and use that form. And then at the end, it's about building value and educating a property owner in the floodplain. So it's no longer just complete the elevation certificate and then pass it back to the homeowner. We have the ability, by being professionals, to be able to provide guidance and say, you know what, you don't have enough flood openings in your crawl space. Sir, ma'am, that's going to translate into a higher risk, therefore a higher premium. I would recommend maybe putting in some flood openings, and that would reduce those flood insurance costs for you. Just a little heads up to the homeowner, and then they can go and do their research and so forth, or recommend SmartFent. We certainly love that for sure. But, little tips like that can build value to an elevation certificate service that you're offering.
Right, and I could see where that would be helpful, even if the purpose for which the surveyor was hired was to help a landowner, property owner, determine what level of insurance they may need or whether or not they even need flood insurance, or if they're making application to get their some special consideration from FEMA or in terms of insurance premiums and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. Even if that's the purpose for why the surveyor is doing the work, having the information in hand that you guys provide would seem to me to be very helpful.
Oh, it's extremely helpful. So with our Flood Risk Evaluator Division, that's really what's branched off from our know-how with SmartFent over the years, and that's our consulting division. And we actually have developed software that allows us to take the elevation certificate, input it into the software, and it actually spits out a mitigation report. And within that mitigation report, it explains to all parties involved the NFIP, the FEMA noncompliance red flags that are translating to a higher flood insurance premium. And then with the report, we build out a scope of work. Okay, maybe you have to put in a few more flood openings. Maybe you have a subgrade space that's causing a red flag. And we break down ways to fix those problems. And then at the end of the report, we then provide a post-modification flood insurance quote. So now the homeowner can actually see what their flood insurance premium will be after they properly mitigate their home. Now, that's the driving force, right? It's to bring the structure into compliance. They're reducing their flood insurance premium. And then, at the same time, what they're doing, though, is they're creating an overall more flood-resistant community, which is the objective of the floodplain manager within that municipality. So it's really the driving force behind change in these communities that are being devastated by flooding events. And so we actually, Kurt, we have surveyors across the country that utilize that service, and then they'll provide the elevation certificate and then one of these reports right behind it. And then it just provides guidance to the homeowner and the answers that they need.
Yeah, I was kind of looking through the website some as we were preparing for the show, and I was reading some of the pretty dramatic changes in premiums that people were seeing because of having done this level of investigation.
It's incredible. I mean, on average, we are able to, and you know, this is through our FRE division, on average, with our know-how, we're saving people 83% a year off their flood insurance premiums. 83% is our going average, and the typical return on investment is seen in about 1.5 to 2 years tops. In a lot of cases, with the flood insurance program, the NFIP, you pay your policy all up front at renewal. So if you get your renewal letter in the mail, it's going to be, say, $3,500. That money is getting, you know, paid out completely. You're not doing it on a monthly payment. You can put it through escrow, but it's still getting paid all up front. And then anything that you do to reduce your risk, like, you know, flood openings or reducing subgrade spaces, they'll send you a difference for whatever you had paid in the form of a refund. So we've seen cases where the retrofit was maybe $1,500, but they saved $2,000 off their flood insurance, so they got that $1,500 back plus, you know, additional $500 and dropped the premium down to a more reasonable rate. And a more reasonable premium is right around $800. It's pretty an average of a low premium. So if anybody's paying over that, then there's certainly going to be an opportunity for us to look at your current situation and give you some guidance on what you could do to reduce that.
And we're 30 seconds away from our first break, so one of the things that came to mind as you were saying that, maybe we can pick up on this when we come back, is I guess the question that came to my mind was, let's say I paid my whatever, $1,800 or whatever I had to pay, and then I came in after the fact, whether or not I'd be able to recoup some of that money or if it didn't take effect till the next time. So maybe when we get back from the break, you can touch on that a little bit, and then we can get into a little bit more detail on some of the government acts that affect all this. So we will
Sounds
be
good.
Right back.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
Quick Stakes is your answer to staking. Lightweight, easy to ride on, easy to use, easy to find, and won't break your...
And here's something new from Schonstedt. Did you know that Schonstedt has upped the ante on trade-ins? Now you can trade in any instrument, theirs or a competitor's, in any condition, working or not, and receive more in trade than ever before. Plus, they'll pay the freight both ways. Contact your local dealer for details or go to Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
Quick Stakes is your answer to staking. Lightweight, easy to ride on, easy to use, easy to find, and won't break your back carrying them like the old-fashioned wooden stakes. Have you tried a sample? If not, get a pen and paper and write down this number, 800-438-4000. 1-800-800-0387 or go to quickstake.com. That's QUIKSTAKE.com and order your samples. Ask your surveying supply dealer for Quickstakes today.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
And we're back with Tom Little with SmartVent Products. We've been talking somewhat in general terms about what SmartVent is and what the products are and services that are provided by the company. And I know one of the questions we kind of wrote down was driving demand for the elevation certificates. And I guess you kind of gave that answer with 83% savings on rates. Of course, I know that's not the only thing, but that's a pretty big
sure.
player, I would think. But I know surveyors, and partially through our government affairs program, hear the terms Biggert Waters and Grim Waters and all the other acts that come along that impact what we're doing. But, you know, I don't think anybody really understands them very much in terms of their breakdown. So maybe you might talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So, you know, as I mentioned before, the key component to reducing somebody's flood insurance premium is you do need a up-to-date elevation certificate, because that's going to provide the information to a group of professionals like us to figure out why you're paying a higher premium, a higher rate. So the driving force behind the EC demand is the fact that the federal government is trying to make the NFIP program fiscally sound again. There's a statistic of how the program's been running, and for every 70 cents in premium that they were bringing in, they were paying out a dollar in flood loss money and claims. So we can kind of do quick math here and know, you know, we're losing 30 cents every time we're sending out a dollar here, and that's not a good business. And the whole objective of the program is to, it's designed to protect properties within the floodplain and to provide, you know, a federally backed flood insurance policy to those folks. Well, a big component of the NFIP is when it was, you know, adopted into use, it was kind of born out of the Flood Insurance Act of 1968. And when the program was born, they had all these properties that were labeled pre-firm. And pre-firm stands for basically you were built before the floodplain maps ever existed, before any of the regulations existed in that particular community. And those homes, FEMA, the NFIP, gave a free pass to, Kurt. They said, you know what, it's not your fault your house was built in, you know, 1950. And now there's these new rules out. We're going to subsidize your risk and absorb it amongst all the other properties that are being built now with these newer regulations. And what they found is, and this consisted of, there's about 20% of the NFIP policies in force fall into this pre-firm, before the maps were adopted into place, pre-firm status. Well, most of those properties consist of where majority of the claims end up going in a given year. So, in 2011, enter Biggert Waters, okay? And President Obama signed Biggert Waters into effect, and a lot of people think, actually, I'm sorry, July of 2012 is when Biggert Waters was actually signed into place. A lot of folks thought it was a result of Hurricane Sandy or Superstorm Sandy. Sandy hit the Northeast in October of 2012, and so this was actually signed in place. And the reason that it really came about, all this NFIP reform, if you look back, and in 2005, you know, we dealt with the Hurricane Katrina's hitting the Gulf, and that year in 2005, premiums generated amongst the NFIP program were at $1.9 billion. And then if we look at the lost dollars paid out, this is the claims that we're paying out, we paid out close to $18 billion in flood claims in 2005. So you can kind of do the math and know, okay, I'm bringing in $2 billion, but I'm sending out $18 billion. We got a major issue here. And that's really when the discussion started, like, we need to update our maps. And that's when we saw a lot of new firms coming out via the map modernization program. And then as we progress you know, we started to improve some of our regulations and so forth from a building construction standpoint. And then, boom, 2012, you know, the Northeast gets walloped with a storm. And just to give you those statistics, in 2012, the year that Sandy hit, the program overall brought in $3.3 billion in premium and paid out close to $9 billion. And so really, you know, Biggert Waters came from a program standpoint at the perfect time, and really the objective of Biggert Waters and the Grim Waters program, which they act, pardon me, they like to call the HFIAA, which stands for the Homeowners Flood Insurance Affordability Act, is they're taking everybody to their actuarial rates. So they're saying, you know what, before, Kurt, if you were built pre-firm, we were subsidizing your rate. We're sorry, we no longer can do that. We need to phase you in to your actuarial risk rating, and that's where you're seeing the EC demand come about, because 9 out of 10 times, Kurt, being pre-firm, I'll use you as an example still here, you're pre-firm, you don't have an elevation certificate on file. So FEMA's raising your premiums anywhere between 18 and 25% annually until you reach your actuarial risk rating. Well, we don't know where that is, where you're going to top out at, unless we get an elevation certificate on file. And we don't know solutions to your rising rates unless we have the elevation certificate to identify those issues.
So was the strategy then, because of the pre-firm, and as you said, there's no information really in a document, and so in assessing what someone who had previously been a pre-firm, what they would pay, was that then based on the newer studies?
Right. So the way that the NFIP works, if you got an elevation certificate, the surveyor is going to utilize the best firm data available. Mm-hmm. All right. So whatever map's in place at the time of the elevation certificate. Now, in some instances, they still have these subsidized rates available. I'll clarify that. They do have these subsidized rates available, but they're phasing them out with increases between 18 and 25%. If your elevation certificate shows that you're in compliance, and maybe there's some minor modification we need to make, like putting in proper flood vents, then you will be rated off of your elevation certificate, and because it's going to read you're in compliance, and hopefully it translates into a couple hundred dollars. But if we look at the elevation certificate and your house is just sitting too low, maybe it's slab on grade, and in those situations, we really, you know, have to consider elevating the house, lifting it up, then you'll still fall into the pre-firm category because you get better ratings. So no matter what, the NFIP sides with the resident, the homeowner, and allows them to take advantage of subsidized rates if it's in their benefit. So it really is whatever's in the benefit of the homeowner, the NFIP is looking out for them, but Biggert Waters and Grim Waters, the objective is to phase out all of those subsidized rates and bring everybody to their actuarial risk rate. And that's why it's so critical to have that elevation certificate on file, because the only way to know what a homeowner can do to reduce their risk, therefore reduce their premium, is to have that data on that form. And that kind of guides us through the path.
So basically anybody who was in that situation, well, I guess anybody that's in a flood-prone area, obviously, but the people who were pre-firm previously, it makes sense that they would want to have an elevation certificate to get the real facts, so to speak, on what they should be paying.
You hit the nail right on the head. That's exactly right. It's and it's you know, talking to other insurance professionals, they sometimes have the impression that, well, you're still getting that subsidized rate, you're good to go. And FEMA has come out with bulletins going direct to residents that say that you will probably need an elevation certificate. And if you've ever seen one of my classes, I X out the probably, because the only way to know when we're going to click the button off to stop increasing your rates, and the only way to know what we can do to solve your higher risk, is to have that elevation certificate. And I stress updated elevation certificate, because we all know the form has definitely progressed over the years. And the data found on today's form gives an insurance professional so much detail that they can ensure that they are properly rating that structure, and it will identify, you know, the major issues. And one of the major issues is, it's found in sections A8 and A9. These are your flood opening sections. And I always, it's pretty simple checkpoint that any surveyor can do when they're doing these elevation certificates. If the number in A is bigger than the number found in C, in A8 or A9, well, then that's going to read that there's not enough flood vents in whatever that enclosure is below the BFE, and it's not going to be exempt from rating. And in the insurance profession, we are always looking for the lowest rated floor. So when a crawl space or a garage doesn't have adequate flood openings, we're not using the next higher floor that's hopefully above the BFE or at least at BFE. We're not going to use that as our rated floor. We're going to use the top of the crawl space floor or the top of the garage as our lowest rated floor, and that's when you end up with a negative. You end up with like a negative 4 or negative 5, which when you see those, now you're talking a few $1,000s for flood insurance premiums. So the goal is we got to make that compliant by putting in flood openings to relieve the hydrostatic pressure off the supporting walls, and all we're doing is equalizing that hydrostatic load on either side, allowing the water to come in and come out. We're just allowing Mother Nature to do her thing, and we're going with the flow. The other thing about, you know, allowing that crawl space to flood is the fact that you don't lose the flood storage capacity of the footprint of that crawl space. So if you had, you know, 30 homes along a river and there weren't proper flood openings, A, yes, the foundation could collapse. And then also B, from a floodplain management standpoint, that water is not going into that space. It's got to go elsewhere. And that's when you start to see it where flood water can adversely affect surrounding properties. But it all starts, again, with that elevation certificate, and in sections A8 and A9, that's probably one of the number one red flags is inadequate flood opening.
And it would, based on what you're saying, and not that, as you know, surveyors are pretty meticulous people, but having a better understanding of why all of this is important and why it's important to get it done very, very accurately, I think makes a lot of difference, because sometimes I'll hear people say, wow, how am I supposed to get that, or that kind of comment you hear sometimes. But when you hear the perspective that you're talking about, it makes it very clear that every little detail is critical.
That it's so, so very critical. And to help guide surveyors through flood openings, Kurt, we've actually, our FRE division, teamed up with Lisa Jones, who's the former South Carolina NFIP coordinator. And we collaborated with Lisa because one of the biggest issues with flood openings, with non-engineered openings, okay, these are devices that aren't specifically designed as flood openings.
I hate to interrupt you, Tom, but we're coming up on our break.
We are?
So
okay.
Before you get into that too far, maybe we'll pick up on that when we come back. That can be our next topic for discussion.
Perfect.
So we'll be back shortly.
Schonstedt Instrument Company has been making locating easier since 1953. First, with its yellow stick, the GA52CX, the industry standard for sensitivity. Then, the GA72CD, a shorter and more rugged version offering a magnetic polarity display and a battery and sensitivity indicator. And most recently, the GA92XT, built for portability. It retracts to fit in its holster and extends for one-handed operation and fingertip control. See them all at schonstedt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on americaswebradio.com.
Quick Stakes. Does your survey supply dealer have Quick Stakes? If not, demand that they start carrying Quick Stakes. Did you know that Quick Stakes are better for your back than your local chiropractor? Lightweight and easier to use than the old heavy wooden stake. Order a sample today and prove it to yourself. Quick Stakes, your back-friendly stake.
getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
And we're at the spot in the show now where our sponsor, Parker Davis Quick Stakes, sponsors our contest for the week. And the first person to repeat the answer I get when I ask a question to Tom by emailing quickstakescontest@americaswebradio.com will be our winner for the day. So, Tom, I'm going to make this easy. You, in the early part of our discussion, you told me there was a percentage of savings in flood insurance by going through this process we're talking about. And what was that number?
That number is 83%.
83% is the answer we're looking for today. So the first person who sends that in by email will be our winner for today. Thanks for participating in that, Tom. But before we went to break, you were talking about an issue that was really important, and I didn't want to get you into it and then stop you. So if you can pick up where you left off.
Absolutely. So we were talking about sections A8 and A9 on the elevation certificate, and the number one red flag that our team sees resulting in a higher premium is the fact that there aren't adequate flood openings in an enclosed area below the BFE. And I'm talking crawl spaces, garages, some cases it's a walkout type of enclosure used for storage and parking only. We can't have finished space below the base flood elevation. But if the number in A, which is the square footage of that enclosure, if that number is larger than the total net area of flood openings, and that number is found in C, then there's not adequate flood venting in that space. And therefore, we're not going to exempt that from flood insurance rating. And that's the goal. We want to exempt crawl spaces and so forth from rating and use the next higher floor as our lowest rated floor. A big issue with identifying compliance with what is characterized as non-engineered vents. And these are vents, again, that aren't specifically designed as flood openings. They're typically air vents in the marketplace. They're classified as non-engineered. FEMA requires the surveyor to document the net open area of those devices in Section A8 and A9. The problem with them, Kurt, though, is the shapes, the sizes, the grills, the louvers, and so forth, all of those things, they impede the flow of flood water, so you have to deduct them from the net open area that that vent's going to provide. So in other words, a 16x8 opening with an air vent device inserted into it, which is practically what we see all across the country, that does not measure 128 square inches. That's the gross area, but we're looking for the net, and that involves measuring and deducting for the grill and the louvers and so forth. It's always been difficult and time-consuming, and you try to look up the manufacturer's information, and maybe they don't even have it posted. So we teamed up with our FRE division, teamed up with Lisa Jones out of South Carolina, and we developed a non-engineered opening field guide. And within this guide, we actually worked with the ASFPM and a lot of their state floodplain managers, along with our team of representatives in the field, to identify what vents are being used as non-engineered openings. And a lot of these are back in the early 90s, these were being installed before engineered openings really became popular. So they're kind of, you know, grandfathered in. But we've identified all these vents, and there's about 31 of them, I believe, now in the guide. And we actually drew each one to scale in AutoCAD. So they're within 1/64th of an inch accuracy. So it's like a human hair from an accuracy standpoint. And we were able to determine the true net open area. And it's documented with a picture of the vent and then a dimensions of the vent along with the net open area that our findings produced. And it's really a helpful guide if you'd like to request a copy of that. You can actually either go to smartvent.com or just from a flood venting technical resource side of things, go to floodvent.com, and there's a little hot button where you could click to request a free copy. And we have literally pocket size and full size versions. But yeah, you can download the guide in a PDF format and feel free to email us. So we're happy to send out copies. But that really helps to complete sections A8 and A9 to ensure that that homeowner gets properly rated for flood insurance. I've seen it many times, Kurt, where 128 square inches is put down, and from a building department standpoint, the EC reads that it's in full compliance. Well, when the underwriters get it from an NFIP standpoint, I've also seen where they know that that vent doesn't cover 128, maybe covers 42. They actually change that in the system, and unfortunately, the unexpected, uninformed homeowner pays the price when their flood insurance premium comes back to be around $3,500. And in some cases, it's just a matter of, well, if you know what, if you retrofitted in three ICC-certified flood vents, it would reduce the flood insurance cost by $3,000. Simple little things like that, but the guide is really a helpful tool.
So is the guide set up based on size and material, or is it set up so some, and perhaps the vents aren't labeled in terms of who made them or what their time frame is. So from the surveyor's perspective, if I'm going into somebody's underneath portions of their house, their crawl space or basement or whatever the case is, and mm-hmm. and I find something, is there I know you said you had some materials that you that are available and examples. But is that based on the way it looks, or is it a particular name or something in terms of a particular model of a vent or something? Or I guess I'm just curious, how does the surveyor know what he's looking at?
Sure, absolutely. So as you come up to a crawl space, you're going to, walk the perimeter of the foundation to determine if, in fact, there's any flood openings within the required height. Okay, so all of your flood vents need to be within 12 inches of the highest adjacent grade directly below the opening. So if the outside's the higher of the two grades, the bottom of the vent needs to be within 12 inches of that grade. If the inside's higher, then 12 inches from the inside. No higher than 12, though. The lower you can go, the better. So you're going to check the perimeter of that foundation, and you're going to see, okay, I'm looking at an air vent. It's 16 by 8. Inside the guide that I'm referring people to go to floodvent.com and download, you will see a picture of that vent. And within the, and then you can double check the measurements of it, and we have the measurements within the guide as well. So you might see a figure 15, and you guys aren't looking at this, but figure 15 is a masonry style slider vent, and the material it's constructed out of, well, it's a galvanized metal, and then we can see the net open area is 45 square inches, and then there's some pointers like compliancy notes. Well, all flood openings need to be totally passive, meaning they need to operate without human intervention. So if there's a cover over the opening when you're inspecting it for the EC, well, that's going to be a zero because that cover is going to obviously impede the flow, and Mr. and Mrs. Smith aren't going to be able to run out there before that flood and remove that cover. So that's not passive. So anything that has a closing mechanism on it, FEMA actually requires that device, if it's being used as a non-engineered opening, it needs to be disabled in the open position. And so I like to clean up disable and just say, well, it needs to be broken in the open position. So you got to make sure that it's broken. All those compliancy notes are included for each one of the figures with the image. And we actually encourage, this is supposed to be a revolving guide, so we encourage, if you identify a non-engineered opening in this field, an air vent that's not included, if you take a picture and give us the dimensions, we'll locate the vent, purchase it, and then our engineering team will actually draw it to scale and then provide you with the net free area based off of those drawings.
Yeah, and that would be very helpful because what I'm hearing you say is that from the surveyor's perspective, the person who's out gathering the data, the diligence we exercise in finding all this information and reporting it properly and asking the right questions if we don't know is every bit as important as all of that same kind of diligence we would put into determining where somebody's property boundary is with somebody else. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is that this isn't just sort of haphazard or casual observation. You really need to know pretty precisely what you're talking about, it sounds to me.
Absolutely. The passion that surveyors put into to boundaries and ensuring that those elevations are spot on need to be applied to the flood opening section as well, because those elevations are really, you know, if your house is built 5 feet above the base flood elevation, your first living floor, if there are not adequate flood openings or if they're not documented properly in A8 or A9, then that property owner is not going to receive proper rating. It's just not going to happen. And so, if you put enough if you put the same amount of passion that you do in those boundaries with the flood openings, then you're going to be producing a better product for your client at the end of the day. And the non-engineered opening guide has really gotten rid of the bottleneck for doing that, Kurt. It's always been – it's extremely hard when you come up to a vent in the field and you're dealing with a grill and a louver. And then there's some – especially like in the New Orleans area, they have these cast iron oval vents. Well, to try to figure out what those little holes are going to cover for net open area, it's like impossible. And we've seen cases where those have been rated at, you know, 150 square inches, and in the guide, it's listed right in there. It only covers 19.5 square inches. Unless you have it in actual AutoCAD, you couldn't even figure it out. You'd give it to 10 different engineers and just give them a tape measure, and you'd probably get 10 different answers. But when you draw it to scale, it tells the story.
Well, we've got a minute and a half or so before our break, but one of the things that came to mind as you were talking about this, and we're looking here at any variety of age of structure. I mean, obviously, you're going to be sometimes looking at structures that have been there a really long time, and you're looking at structures that have been fairly recently constructed. So I guess a question in my mind is, do the building codes pretty well keep up with all of these issues in terms of installation of new vents?
They do, and there's some really good technical resources pertaining to flood openings, one in which is called Technical Bulletin 1, and this is a FEMA document, and it was released in 2008, but it really provides intimate details, the guidance to conform to the Code of Federal Regulation. And then the ICC, the International Residential Codes, the International Building Codes, the 2015 edition, that's out and about, and states are starting to adopt that into practice. And then most recently, ASCE 24, so the American Society of Civil Engineers, just released their new flood design construction requirements, ASCE 24-14. It came out in December, which really has been cleaned up to reflect what we've learned since the last edition of ASCE 24, which was from 2005. So it encompasses all of the best practices discovered through, you know, the Hurricane Katrina's and the Sandy's. And there they've really started to clarify what a compliant flood opening is. And all of these documents, are referred to by the National Flood Insurance Program. So if everybody's on the same page, the building department, the surveyor, and the insurance professional, with just the flood opening materials, then the result is that client, that resident, is going to have a protected home with a low flood insurance premium.
That makes sense, and here we are at the end of our third segment. So let's go to our break, and we'll come back and wrap up.
Schonstedt Instrument Company has been making locating easier since 1953, first with its yellow stick, the GA52CX, the industry standard for sensitivity, then the GA72CD, a shorter and more rugged version offering a magnetic polarity display and a battery and sensitivity indicator, and most recently, the GA92XT, built for portability. It retracts to fit in its holster and extends for one-handed operation and fingertip control. See them all at Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
Quick Stakes is your answer to staking. Lightweight, easy to ride on, easy to use, easy to find, and won't break your back carrying them like the old-fashioned wooden stakes. Have you tried a sample? If not, get a pen and paper and write down this number, 800-438-4000. 1-800-288-0387 or go to quickstake.com. That's QUIKSTAKE.com and order your samples. Ask your surveying supply dealer for Quickstakes today.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details. Or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back for our last segment today with Tom Little with Smart Vent. And we talked about a lot of things today, and I know one of the things we said we wanted to talk about was some key pointers for those, finding those red flags that surveyors can have in the back of their mind as they're going out on sites.
Right. So, you know, looking at the elevation certificate, we identified how flood openings are probably the number one red flag, and that's A8 and A9. The other one is subgrade spaces. So if we're looking at the building diagrams found in the instruction section of the elevation certificate, subgrade spaces would be like a diagram 2 or a diagram 4, a diagram 9. Those are also major red flags. And in a lot of cases, we'll see where it's a combination of, yes, the property needs flood openings, but also there's a subgrade space. So from a building department enforcement standpoint, the building official may require, they're going to require flood openings in a diagram 9 subgrade crawl space. All right, because it's an enclosed area below the BFA. However, that could be causing a major issue from a flood insurance standpoint, because when it's subgrade, you're dealing with two additional forces during a flood. You're dealing with, yes, the lateral forces, which your flood openings are going to relieve that, but then you can also be dealing with saturated soils that exert even more pressure on the wall, and then also buoyancy forces that can actually uplift the house off of its foundation. So those red flags need to be fixed, okay, with regard to subgrade spaces. So a lot of our installers, Kurt, will actually come in, and they have machines. They have tools that will actually pump in clean fill material to raise the elevation of that crawl space floor and eliminate that subgrade area. Or it's a matter of us excavating some of the soil around that lowest adjacent wall to lower the lag down. So the rule of thumb is, and this actually assists you when determining a building diagram number to attach to an EC, but when you're looking at Section C, where all of our elevation information is, the top of the bottom floor, you're going to document that elevation in letter A. All right. The lowest adjacent grade, the lag, is found in F. And as an insurance professional, when we're rating a building or a home for flood insurance, the two most important elevations are the top of the bottom floor, which is found in A, and letter F, which is the lowest adjacent grade. We actually don't even look at the HAG. The lag is the most important, the lowest adjacent grade. So if the number in A, which is our crawl space floor, top of our crawl space floor, if that is lower than the number in F, all right, which is our lag, that's an immediate red flag that space is subgrade. So much like you're doing in sections A8 and A9, where you're checking the square footage of the crawl space, and say you had a 1,000-square-foot crawl space, you need at least 1,000 square inches or square foot of flood venting protection. And if you have only 900 square foot or square inches of flood venting protection, well, that's not enough, and it's going to be a red flag. It's not going to be exempt for rating. The same applies to Section C. So if your lag number is higher than the top of the bottom floor elevation, then that's a red flag, and that's going to be a subgrade space. And that's when we're going to have to excavate or bring in some fill. The results, you know, when you look at, oh, wow, I got to bring in you know, I have folks that are actually filling in their basements, and you're like, whoa, filling in your basement, that's crazy. Well, you know what's even more crazy is paying $8,000-$9,000 a year for flood insurance. It's not financially doable for most of these property owners. So you're going to give up that space, but you're going to reduce your flood insurance rates premiums down to only, you know, $900, $800 a year. So those are the two major red flags, just to, you know, wrap that up, or inadequate flood openings, and when your lag is higher than the top of the bottom floor, that's a red flag that it's a subgrade space.
Just out of curiosity, is there any time frame where one would look at the age of a house, for example, and have some idea of, trying to get to the right question here, whether or not there's any venting or adequate venting? I mean, obviously we talked about earlier building codes keeping up with things, but is there any kind of rules of thumb about that, or are they all different depending on where you live?
No. From a flood venting standpoint, it's standard across the board, whether you're referencing FEMA and the NFIP, the building codes, or your ASCE standards. And the requirement is simple. If you, for every 1 square foot of enclosed area that you have, you need 1 square inch of flood ventilation. So it's a 1-to-1 ratio.
So one of the reasons I asked that question is the house I grew up in down in the mountains in southwestern Virginia was kind of sitting on a hillside, and I don't recall ever seeing any kind of venting in it for floods. And of course, when the rain came down off the hills, sometimes it collected behind the house, and then we'd get water in the basement. But the reason I asked that question was, and that house was built in the mid to late 40s. So I was just curious if there was a time when nobody even worried about this, or I guess it kind of depends on where you live if you're worried about it.
Well, for sure. So when it comes to flood venting, if you fall into a special flood hazard area, all right, these are your A and your V zones. These are the areas that your lender, your mortgage provider, is going to require you to have flood insurance to protect your home, to protect to protect that loan. And so when you're in an A zone, Kurt, and you have an enclosure, a crawl space or a walkout, you know, enclosure like you're describing, A zones, you're required to have flood openings. That really came about in 1983. That's really when it was like, you know what, if you're in one of these zones, you need to put in flood vents to relieve pressure. This is a good idea because we're seeing walls collapse. We're seeing issues. If you're falling outside of an A zone and you're in, say, an X zone, so you're not in that special flood hazard area, and you have a crawl space, more than likely, yeah, you're going to have air vents for natural air ventilation. In a situation like you were in the 1950s with that type of construction, yeah, you're not going to have any flood openings in there. But that's where we would come in, and we actually just mitigated a gentleman's house. His name is Don Powell, and he's up in the Rochester, New York area. And Don's house was built in 1894, and Don was paying over $3,200 a year for flood insurance. And the surveyor sent in his elevation certificate to try to help Mr. Powell out. You know, good old American, Vietnam veteran, great guy, but wasn't getting any answers of what could be done. So I reviewed his elevation certificate and noticed that he was a diagram 7. So for our listeners, a diagram 7 is a walkout enclosure, right? And so I immediately think, well, maybe Mr. Powell's got that area finished. And you can't have finished area below the BFE. If not, your flood insurance is going through the roof. Well, he had a dirt floor in his basement. Again, his house was built in 1894. The solution was all we needed to do was put in 4 of our flood vents, our insulated smart vent models, and it reduced his flood insurance premium down to $396. And I actually have a picture of Mr. Powell. He sent me a picture of his refund check, and he got a refund check of $2,800 by putting in those 4 flood openings. So you can even mitigate those homes in the 50s, 1800s. You know, it shifted him from a negative 6 to a plus 3, and that's why he saw those significant savings.
And I guess that really points out, and we've got 4.5 minutes or so left, but this just kind of points out, I guess, the effectiveness of doing things the right way.
Absolutely, absolutely. And after the Katrinas and the Superstorm Sandys, there's task force that go out on behalf of FEMA. And what they're doing is, you know, they want to identify what worked, what mitigation steps worked, what communities that are maybe going above and beyond the minimum standards, how did they survive? And there's a really good best practice video that FEMA put out in Seabright, New Jersey. Seabright, it was scary. We did a lot of work up there to help some folks after the storm. And just there were dumpsters everywhere, blue tarps on the roof. It literally looked like a war zone. And I got a call from the office, and they said, Tom, you're not going to believe this house that survived the storm. It looks like it's brand new. And Seabright's a small, small town. And I look over to the left and hear this beautiful set of townhouses look like they built it the week after the storm. I'm like, there's no way this went through this storm, because 70% of the town was declared substantially damaged. I mean, Kurt, it was bad. And so I walk up to this house, and FEMA ended up doing a video on it. They had compliant flood openings. They built their first floor 2 foot higher than what they were required to based off of the floodplain maps. And you know what? When the storm came, they were the water actually came within 6 inches of the subfloor. So what does that tell us? Well, if they didn't go up higher than what they were supposed to, they would have had a foot and a half of flood water in their first living floor, a significant claim, and they would have been out of their house in temporary housing as that work, as they, you know, cleaned up, you know, the drywall and rip all that out, probably had to rip out the kitchen and so forth. So going above and beyond really showed, hey, your house can survive. And now those homeowners, as soon as they were letting people back onto the island, they were able to get back into their house. So if you go to smartvent.com and then click on videos, you'll see some other of those other videos and best practices pertaining to doing things the right way and in some cases going above and beyond, you know, with the height requirements and so forth.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's probably a good idea for anybody to do some assessment of where they are and think about, you know, do I really have what I need here? Because I don't think the normal home buyer, if they're not living in what everybody thinks of as a flood-prone area, might even be thinking about that. So,
right. And the old rule of thumb when you're in the insurance business, especially our flood insurance businesses, regardless if you're in an A or a V zone, everybody's in a floodplain.
Right.
Everybody's in a floodplain, and when you're falling outside of an A or a V zone, you can qualify for what's called a preferred risk flood insurance policy. And those are typically only a few $100s, but it gives you protection that your homeowner's policy will not cover. They do not cover flood. So if you're right on the outskirts of an A or a V zone, it's not going to hurt to pull the trigger and preferred risk policy to protect yourself.
Yeah, it's one of those things. We all hope we never have to use our insurance, and I guess the only insurance we all have that we know we'll have to use eventually is life insurance, and of course, it's not going to do us much good at that point. It'll probably do somebody some good, but it's always good to look at that. We've got maybe 45 seconds left, so I want to be sure to thank you for joining me today, Tom. It's been a great, great program, and I know what our listeners are going to do. They're going to put this, and they're going to download it, and they're going to go back and listen to it in little increments so they can capture all the things you've had to say today, because there's been so much good information. So I really appreciate you joining me.
Hey, well, thanks so much for having me on, and it was a great experience. And if there's any questions, you can send an email to info@smartvent.com. There's a link on our website, smartvent.com.
Okay. That sounds great. I'm sure you're probably going to be hearing from a lot of people, because everything we've said today is important to everybody, but certainly is important to surveyors. So thanks again for joining me today, Tom. I've really enjoyed having you on the show.
Thanks a bunch. Appreciate it.
Take care.
See you now.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.